This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by Go Engineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit theuavdigest.com/goengineer. And by UAV Propulsion Tech, a provider of propulsion, servo, autopilots, and rescue and recovery parachute solutions for the unmanned aerial vehicle market. For more information, check out www.uavpropulsiontech.com. You're listening to episode 78 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, with a bit of an apology for this coming out late, folks. Unfortunately, I've been a little sick, so it's all my fault, not Max's. So we're trying to get this out sort of on time, and not bad for having one down after doing 78 of them. So I think we're still doing a good thing on release dates.
I know. You know what the hardest thing about this, David, being one day later, is so many things happen day by day that it's hard not to just keep adding more and more and more topics in that that we'd want to talk about. So, but I think we have a good collection, some interesting stuff going on lately.
The big one, of course, was a drone on the White House front lawn. Actors pretending to be drone pilots, a waterproof drone that swims with the fishes, fighting fires with optionally manned helicopters. I really like this story. A series long UAS flight, how some countries outside of the U.S. view drones, and the FAA dribbles out two more exemptions for our weekly This Week in Exemption segment. So yes. We should get started. Well, the big news of the week was the ubiquitous DJI Phantom became a bit notorious by crashing on the front lawn of the White House. Our first story is from abcnews.go.com. Small drone crashes on White House complex. Origins are unclear. Well, that was Monday of this week. By Tuesday, we got GeekWire saying, don't drink and drone. Man crashed drone while White House drinking. And then we find out that not only does the man drinking at 3 o'clock in the morning fly his drone, he actually works for a government spy agency.
That's right. The National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. So, yeah, this is just some bizarre behavior. And, you know, the stories are, they have little different angles on it, depending on who's providing the, quote, facts surrounding this. But apparently this guy was in an apartment not too far from the White House, and they had a DJI Phantom in there, and I think he was even flying it around inside a little bit, but decided that he would send it out the window into the night and then bring it back in and then send it out again. And that's when things started to go bad, I guess.
I tweeted out on my personal account the comment about, you know, it's 3 a.m. I really don't feel like drunk calling my ex, so why don't I go fly a drone? None of this makes sense, folks. And of course, this is the kind of thing that gives UAVs and drones a bad name, and you just sort of have to wonder. But it is really kind of amazing that it has sparked some controversy, and it also has sparked some comment from, especially from the White House. Now, agreed, the president wasn't in the White House at the time, but he does think the FAA needs to step up on drone policy.
Yeah, this had a number of interesting results, as you say, David. All these press stories, and it just, you know, one after another, and it's just been sort of inundating people. It's good, you know, these are good stories. Or if you're in that business, in the journalism business, this is a great topic to, you know, it provides so much great material for you. And yeah, bringing to light in a sort of national forum that the regulations for drones need to be in place, and that, you know, we have some issues with them not there yet. Bad behavior flying a drone at night. There's no line of sight there when you fly it out your bedroom window or your apartment window at night. The other thing is that the guy who was actually flying this, it wasn't his drone. It was owned by a friend. And in the New York Times piece, anyway, there's some information apparently from the friend who says that the Phantom is really more at fault here than the operator, because it took off on its own. The article says that it rose up hundreds of feet into the night sky. I'm not sure how they knew that, before taking off at a high speed due east. And this friend says that this is a problem that's known to be a flaw in Phantoms. And that, you know, that's really, that some of the blame lays there, which I don't know, that sounds kind of weak to me.
When in doubt, blame the drone.
Blame the drone.
Isn't that why we started this show? Was everybody was blaming the drones and it really wasn't their fault?
Exactly.
But the other really interesting thing was the DJI coming out with a major software update. This was from UASVision.com. DJI says it will disable all of its devices within a 15.5-mile radius of downtown Washington, D.C. This will come through a mandatory software update that will disable drone flights over Washington, D.C. and around 10,000 U.S. airports.
Yeah, this is interesting. This is a great, I think, a great move on the part of DJI. What's really impressive is how quickly I think they responded to this. And the software update, they call it a mandatory update, but you don't have to download the update. You don't have to install it. But if you don't, then any future updates from DJI, you won't be able to take advantage of. So there's a motivation to keep your software current. But this is interesting that, you know, DJI is taking this stand. We've talked about them with some of their software and how it behaves around airports in the past. So that they can do this so quickly is pretty impressive, I think.
I think it more the point it was being worked on already. I think they just released it quicker. I mean, 10,000 airports, that's a lot of programming. So it just means that I will not be able to fly my DJI Phantom when I get it where I live, because I'm within a mile and a half of an airport.
You know, that's exactly what Drone Mama said to me today. She said, what happens if you know, I don't even know if she was thinking about you specifically, David, but she said, what happens if you live really close to an airport? That means you can't fly in your own backyard. And I guess that applies to you, doesn't it?
It does.
Wow.
Oh, well, I will have to find a better place to go fly my drone. Or I can keep it simple and still try to figure out how to master that Christmas present of mine that bounces off walls.
There you go.
But speaking of drone piloting, it sounds like, this was from foreignpolicy.com, Ethan Hawke and Anne Hathaway will be playing drone pilots in upcoming movies.
Ethan Hawke is in this movie that's called Good Kill. He's a star of that, and he plays the part of a drone pilot. He starts to question, I guess, the ethics of his job. Now, when we say drone pilot here, we're talking about a military drone pilot. And so this is almost a no-brainer for Hollywood, that particular storyline, because it's something that, well, we've seen a real-life pilot for the Air Force, didn't we, in the news not too long ago, who kind of started to question the morality of some of the things that he was doing.
Yeah, and Anne Hathaway is doing an off-Broadway one-woman title play called Grounded. And she plays an Air Force pilot who is assigned to fly drones. So, and we've had this conversation that there's a lot of U.S. Air Force pilots that have been routed the drone routes that aren't happy about getting their flight time from a box. So,
yeah.
Interesting. We'll see what it means. I guess we'll have to do a movie review when Good Kill comes out. And I don't know who's closer to New York to go see an off-Broadway play. So, Max, you'll have to work on that.
All right.
Well, our next story is kind of, I thought this was kind of cool because it sort of followed on our video of last week, which was the drone that crashed into the water. And this was from ambientreallife.com.
This is a drone that's supposed to go in the water.
It's a drone that's capable of going in the water, and it's quite capable of filming some neat stuff. So there is really much not to say about it other than it's kind of cool, and it dovetails off of last week. But definitely look in the show notes and take a look at it and see what you think. If there's a viable economics to a drone that can land in the water and take pictures and then, I guess, take off again.
And this is not a submarine, right? This is not something that goes under the water. My understanding here is that it sort of lands on the water, is capable of it, and skims along.
I don't think it's submergible, but that doesn't mean it won't be coming someday.
You know, another application for this, I don't know, David, might be that you could fly in perhaps worse weather than you might otherwise. I mean, I'm thinking about in rain, maybe not heavy downpours, but in light rain, where maybe you wouldn't normally be able to fly. Say, like in a search and rescue kind of an operation, where you're looking for an individual, someone who's lost out there, and it starts to rain, and you know, maybe with the hardware we have now, you'd have to bring the thing in and have to discontinue the search. But maybe with something like this, you could keep on going. I don't know.
That sounds reasonable. I mean, the search and rescue options definitely, I think, is where this would be headed. We'll keep an eye out on it. Let's talk about more search and rescues. Otherwise, the U.S. Interior Department wants drones now, or optionally manned helicopters.
Right. The U.S. Department of the Interior, they want to investigate the use of optionally piloted helicopters, and in this case, for forest firefighting. And they say they want to, quote, assess the feasibility of utilizing these types of aircraft for a variety of missions, including but not limited to fire suppression at night and during low visibility conditions, as well as cargo delivery. And there's some craft out there that kind of might fit this bill already, aren't there?
Yeah, Cayman and Lockheed Martin have the K-Max, which is a optionally manned helicopter that they've actually been using by the Marines and the Army in Afghanistan to carry supplies to forward operating bases. Completely unmanned, programmable, and usually the cargo was slung load, so I could see a basket. I could see them sling loading water and having a program routine where you'd go to a lake, pick up the water, fly over the target, and then repeat the process.
Yeah.
Northrop Grumman has their MQ-8 Fire Scout, which is a fully unmanned Bell 407. We talked about that, which is a growth of the MQ-8C. And last but not least, Sikorsky has their Matrix project, which has worked on an S-76, their civilian helicopter, but they've also have been working with the Army on H-60s, which already do fire suppression. So the information's out there for them to do it.
I think it's interesting that they say that they're looking for a helicopter that can fly manned or unmanned. The MC-8C Fire Scout, you can't fly that manned, right? It's a full-sized helicopter, but it's only flown unmanned. I don't know why the Interior wants a sort of a dual-use helicopter.
I guess my opinion on the subject is sometimes it's better have eyes on the target than eyes via video camera on the target.
It sounds like that makes sense. But it occurs to me that it might be a more expensive option. It seems like if you could build it and fly it unmanned, and then say, well, you know what, it needs to be able to accommodate, you know, a human pilot as well. It sounds like it would cost a lot more, but I don't know.
Well, the other thing about why the Army's looking at the H-60 project and the Matrix project with Sikorsky is the hardware is already built, Max. All you have to do is put in the equipment to fly it unmanned.
True.
And keep all of the manned stuff. So there is a cost saving that way also.
And then another part of this that mentioned in the article I like is this Lockheed Indigo quadcopter. And we've seen that the idea is that would be launched by a firefighter and fly out to identify potential targets for the K-Max. So it's kind of this dual thing. We talked about this over at Airplane Geeks in a different context, but that's an interesting concept. And they've used that Indigo in Western Australia. They've used it with an infrared sensor to map the fire zone of a fire at night. So another interesting application. Firefighting has just got to be one of the big potential applications for unmanned aircraft.
Having just watched Always, precision aerial firefighting is really necessary, especially out in wildfires out in like Australia or here in the United States. So let's talk about really long endurance flights. This was from defenseupdate.com. Orion UAS breaks flight endurance record on 80-hour mission.
This is from Aurora Flight Sciences, and they say that they've set a new world endurance record for an unmanned aircraft system, and they beat the old official record by quite a bit.
Over 100%. The former was set in 2001 by the RQ-4 Global Hawk, and that was an official record of 30.5 hours.
So going from that to 80 is a big jump.
And I believe that flight was the flight from California to Australia that they flew that RQ-4 on.
Oh.
But 80 hours, 48, 72, that's 3 days plus.
It's pretty impressive. Well, all right, we have some news items from around the world. First of these came in from listener Peter. This is from BBC, Thailand mulls jail term for all unlicensed drone pilots. And this is something that the Thailand Civil Aviation Department is drawing up, some rules that are kind of, well, a little bit different.
Yeah, these are definitely unique. Prohibit attaching cameras to drones except for business reasons, which is completely antithesis to the United States. Drones with cameras could only be used by photographers, filmmakers, and journalists. Okay. There's a one-hour flight time, and they're going to limit the size and the weight of the drones.
So also as part of this, the Thai Ministry of Transport would oversee and also approve applications to use drones. And if you break the rules under this proposal, the penalty is pretty significant. The monetary fine is 40,000 baht, and that's roughly equivalent to about $1,200. But that's not the worst part of the sentence if you violate this stuff.
The worst part, besides the $1,229 fine, is a year in prison. A year in a Thai prison, I might add.
Yeah, well, that would be enough to
deter me.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. And speaking of fines, we've seen in an article that came in via Simon and also Grant from couriermail.com.au, Queensland man first in Australia to be fined for flying a drone. So CASA, the Civil Aviation Safety Authority, fined this guy $850. But he kind of exposed himself to this sort of thing, didn't he?
Yeah. I mean, if you're going to do something illegal and then post it on YouTube, you might expect to be caught.
Yeah, yeah. I think the problem he ran into in this case was flying too close to people. But CASA has regulations. And they're pretty straightforward and kind of the same as what we see elsewhere. Cannot fly within 3 nautical miles of an airport, can't fly above 400 feet, over populated areas, can't fly within 30 meters of people, and here we go, you can't fly at night.
So, yeah, I mean, he was doing a couple of things that violate that on the YouTube video. I don't think we got a link. You know, I wish we had gotten a link to the YouTube, the actual video itself, and I don't believe it was in the article. So if we find it, we'll put that into, it's probably taken down by now anyway, but we'll put it in the show notes.
Great. Moving on, we go to the United Arab Emirates. This is from Emirates247.com, aviation safety, GCAA to issue drone rules. The GCAA is the General Civil Aviation Authority, and they regulate civil aviation in the United Arab Emirates. And they say that they're going to release regulations for UAS.
And they're working on the assumption that they're going to work on weight and the type of operators. And will, of course, ban UAVs near airport, residential areas, public facilities, and properties. That's interesting, the public facilities and properties.
Hmm.
And they're going off the permit will be required by them as well as coordination with air traffic authorities. This is interesting because if you're not going to fly near airports, you're still going to have to coordinate with air traffic authorities. Now, UAE isn't that big, but it's an interesting kind of file your flight plan with the air traffic control before you go flying.
And you know what these stories sort of illustrate is the degree to which different countries, different governments, different regulatory agencies are taking somewhat different approaches. In some cases, there's a lot of overlap. You can see oftentimes sort of copying, I'll say, what the FAA is looking at. But in other cases, you know, they're marching to a different tune, as it were. And there's you know, not a lot of consistency across different countries. I don't know if that's ultimately important or not, but it is interesting that we have those differences.
Well, that brings us back around the world to that all-famous FAA. And instead of making regulations, they went back to doing exemptions.
Right. Two more exemptions added to the list that's still, well, I think you can count the total number on two hands, maybe. It's pretty close to that.
Yeah, well, I think we're getting close to double digits.
So the FAA gave exemptions to two companies, to AeroCin, that's an aerial cinematography outfit, and also to Burns Eye View, which does aerial photography and inspections.
So, and they issued the certificates of airworthiness based on, quote, because they do not pose a threat to national aerospace users or national security.
Right.
Unlike drunken drone flyers over D.C.
The FAA said that, in these two cases, that they did not require certificates of airworthiness.
They're being inconsistent on their exemptions, but I guess that's why they're exemptions and not policies.
And, you know, we can't go with another week without, again, mentioning that the NPRM for small UAS isn't out yet. There's been a lot of articles in the press about that as well. Some of them associated with the Washington White House flight and noting the need for regulations. But most of the articles point to the regulations. The proposed regulations are at the OMB, the Office of Management and Budget. And I guess you'd say, David, that there's a lot of internal government reviews going on. And pretty much everyone's tight-lipped about what's going to come out of that process.
Yeah, I get the impression at this point, there's a lot of people touching it, and it's not going to be as straightforward as we hoped. You know, I mean, this does affect a lot of different organizations. We've talked about the FAA, the FCC, you know, the NTSB, all of that people will get affected by this. But, you know, we're supposed to get the rules out and then discuss them instead of discussing them first.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. 78 weeks ago, I guess we didn't even know what an NPRM was. Right. So I guess you and I have learned a lot. But let's talk about some more positive news, because I'm sure we'll be talking about the NPRM next week. Our video of the week, first commercial drone to take flight over downtown Edmonton.
Yeah, this is great news. Connor Burns of Skymatics has flown the first drone that's approved for operation in downtown Edmonton. And that flight took place on January 28th using a DJI Spreading Wings S-1000. So they have a little video about that flight. I want to thank listener Peter sent the link in the article to us on that.
Yeah, and the octocopter will be used for taking videos of construction projects for a design and planning firm. So good use. Good luck to Connor Burns of Skymatics, and hopefully we'll see more. But we not only do we have one video of the week, we've got two.
This one came in from Drone Mama. There's an article in CNET. Farmer uses drone to capture bird's eye view of, quote, cow art. So this is really clever. You've got to see this. It's fascinating, I think, what two guys have done with a feed truck, some kind of a drone, and a herd of cattle. And we'll just say simply that what they did is they drove the truck around in the field depositing feed and then filmed from up above the cows descending on well, the locations where the feed was placed. So it's kind of humorous. And these two guys, these two good old boys, I think, had a great lot of fun with their pickup truck and their feed. And the resulting cow art is pretty unique.
Time for feedback. And Roger says, I've been hearing the concept of drones having a certificate of airworthiness being mentioned more often. Most people are interested in operating drones, but if drones get C of A's, the design and maintenance of drones may get way more interesting and expensive. And Max, you have a bit of a background in this. You got into an exchange back with Roger, and you kind of agreed with his sentiment.
Yeah, what he's saying is that if you look at how certificates of airworthiness are managed, maintained in manned aircraft, if you just take that and lay that over on the unmanned side, that just opens up a huge can of worms. Certificate of airworthiness is something that requires lots of documentation, any kinds of changes, maintenance performed, any kind of exceptional maintenance, all that kind of thing requires approval, and it's just a very complicated and involved process. In fact, you know, a significant portion of the maintenance cost in manned aviation is just maintaining the physical records and having the approvals to do what you do. That's how you keep maintenance safe. So I think what Roger is saying is that apply that to quadcopters and drones and, you know, vehicles of that sort. And this is really kind of a messy prospect and maybe not very practical in the end. So one thing we're going to have to look for in the NPRM and just as the FAA goes forward and as other regulatory agencies go forward is what are the rules for certificates of airworthiness for these kinds of unmanned aircraft? And, you know, are they going to be just direct copies of what we see, the process we see for manned, or can they be designed so that we still have safe aircraft, but they're not so onerous and expensive and time-consuming? So I think it's a great point that Roger brought up, something that we're going to have to watch very carefully.
Thanks, Roger, for that. It was definitely an eye-opening, considering all of the model aircraft stuff that I have and some of the A4 stuff I have at home. I did remember that, you know, every time you did a change to the airframe, you had to document it. So
right.
Clearly, it's something we need to think about in the drone industry. And they throw out certificates of airworthiness, but they really don't, I think, have looked long-term at what that means.
Right. Hey, just real quick, David, wanted to mention our friend of the podcast, Tim Trott, has an ebook out. It's called The Droner's Guide. We actually have a link on the UAVDigest.com webpage if you're interested in taking a look at that. It's not very expensive. Tim captures a lot of the issues associated with what's going on these days with drones and with regulations and so forth. So just invite listeners to take a look at that and see if it's something that they might be interested in.
Yeah. And of course, we always appreciate Tim and his emails, and it keeps our thinking caps going quite often.
All right. We want to thank everyone for listening. This has been episode 78 of the UAV Digest. You can find us at our website, theuavdigest.com, or you can go straight to the show notes for this episode, which is theuavdigest.com/78. You'll find the links to the news stories, the companies, the drones, all the things that we talk about there. It's a useful reference, so you can do that. But you can also find us in social media.
Yeah, on Twitter, we have a very active Twitter account, which is at UAV Digest. We have a Facebook page, which is UAV Digest. And of course, send us feedback. We love getting the emails. Stories, you know, we don't have access to. We love our foreign listeners that send us our international stories. And that would be feedback@theuavdigest.com. Or if you think Max or I would be more interested in it, it could be david@theuavdigest.com. Or max@theuavdigest.com. And of course, if you love us, leave us feedback on iTunes so that other people can find our little show. And of course, you can stream us to your phone on Stitcher.com. And if you want to buy some UAV Digest swag, check out our cafepress.com/theUAVDigest.
And we also have a way you can help support this effort financially. You can become a patron by visiting patreon.com/theUAVDigest, or you can find the link on our website. And it's very simple. You can support us with a very small, you know, monetary donation. There's a lot of options for doing that. We want to give a shout out to our most recent patron, Stephen. Thank you so much. We really appreciate your support.
And Stephen, I guess Max and I will be in touch with you to get you, given your size of your donation, to get you to have our half-hour conversation chat with you. So look for that email probably in the next week or so.
Fantastic. Well, David, I think that's about it for this episode.
I agree. So we'll say this. This is David in Philly.
And Max in Hartford.
Thanks for listening, everyone.